Coming up on Path to Zero.
70% of people across the U.S. are already worried about climate change. 50% of us feel helpless and don't know where to start. And so where do we find hope in recognizing that there are actions that we can take that will make a difference?
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello and welcome to the Path to Zero. You've tuned in for a good one today, because in this episode, I have the rare privilege of talking to a preeminent climate scientist whom the New York Times described as one of the nation's most effective communicators on climate change. You may know Dr. Catherine Hayhoe from her many appearances on late night talk shows, or perhaps you saw her TED talk that's received over 4 million views. From that talk, she became the nation's evangelist for rational hope. Dr. Hayhoe is the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy. She's a distinguished professor at Texas Tech University. She also hosts and produces the PBS digital series Global Weirding, and has received a number of recognitions, from making the Time 100 list to being named the United Nations Champion of the Earth in Science and Innovation. Dr. Hayhoe, it's great to have you as our guest. Welcome to Path to Zero.
Thank you for having me.
You were really busy in 2021, and we're going to talk a lot about some of your TV appearances, your TED Talk, but let's start talking about the Nature Conservancy, because I think you joined as the chief scientist, and then you came out with a new book, Saving Us, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope and Healing in a Divided World. What caused you to write that book?
So I talk to a lot of people about climate change. I talk to school groups and colleges, churches, business people, community groups, Rotary clubs. And wherever I've been the last few years, no matter who I've been speaking to, I have got the same two questions. And the questions that come up every single time are, how do I have a conversation about this issue with a family member, a neighbor, a colleague, a coworker, someone I know? And what gives you hope when everything just seems to be going the wrong direction, when the world just seems to be getting more and more polarized, when people are breaking up decades-long friendships over disagreements over something that you might think is as simple as a mask, let alone a solar panel? Where do we find hope these days? And so that's why I wrote my book, is to answer those two questions. How do we talk about any contentious, divisive issue with people who we care about in our life? And where do we find that hope that keeps us going?
You know, why do you think sometimes it looks like we see it in politics, but it also see it in society, that some of the civility that we had come to think was normal, we lose that now? People being pulled off planes because they don't want to wear a mask, you know, the civility or lack of it in politics. But why do you think that we seem to be more divisive than ever on some of these topics?
Well, we don't just think that we are. The Pew Foundation has studied this, and they say that we definitely are. They say that in the United States now, people are more politically polarized than they have been since the Civil War. And I mean, that was a time of incredible political polarization. And so that sends up all kinds of red flags. And when we're so polarized, as I talk about in my book, when we're so polarized, we tend to see people who espouse opposing political or ideological views not as fellow citizens of the same nations, but rather as enemies to be defeated. And their gain is our loss. And the opportunity for bipartisanship or for compromise is viewed as weakness rather than strength. And then onto that, we have the internet. And once you're on the internet, you can respond to people any way you want, and there's no consequences because you're not looking at their face. And so I've spoken to thousands of people, many of whom disagree with what I have to say. But when I speak to them in person, the number of person who's willing to actually get up and scream insults into my face in person, I could count on the fingers of one hand in thousands of conversations. But the people who are willing to basically scream insults into my social media feed, and when I say insults, words I don't even want to repeat, that number I can count on all the fingers of my hand in just half a day. And so the internet enables us to detach from the physical reality and the humanness of each other and treat each other as something that is somehow less than human. It enables this behavior. And that's a big part of why we're in this difficulty today. And that's why I advocate having these in-person conversations with people, because conversations are what bring us together. They help us to share what we're thinking about. And too often now, we're just reduced to yelling at each other rather than speaking with each other.
Yeah, so true. Well, let's talk about it. In your book, you really point out polls that have talked about climate change as this terrific, terribly, in fact, polarizing issue. But I might even say that it's paralyzing. New York Times talks about a psychiatrist whose practice is devoted to counseling people who just have dread and doom and fear about climate change. And they literally cannot move past that dread and fear. How do you suggest that we negotiate those extremes so we're having more constructive dialogues? And I would say dialogue that is productive about moving towards solutions. And what do you say to people who are just losing hope?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you had the answer right there in your question, which is we lose hope when we don't think there's anything we can do that will make a difference. When we see something coming and we realize there's nothing we can do, that is where we lose hope. And so where do we find hope in recognizing that there are actions that we can take that will make a difference? When they survey people across the United States, 70% of people across the U.S. are already worried about climate change. When you look at people who are moms, like me, 83% of us moms are worried about climate change. 86% of young people are worried, but half of us, 50% of us, feel helpless and don't know where to start. And only 8% of us would consider ourselves to be activated. So there's this huge gap. And how do we bridge that gap? By recognizing that there are tangible solutions that every single one of us can engage in. I'm not talking about government policies. I'm not talking about, you know, international agreements. And I'm not talking about changing your light bulbs either, because we feel like here's this big global challenge and they're telling us to change our light bulbs and recycle. Well, I've been doing that already for 20 years. It hasn't fixed the problem, has it? No, I'm talking about something that we don't often realize we have, and that is our voice. We have tremendous power to advocate for change wherever we are. We're all part of a community. We might work somewhere. We might go to school somewhere. Our kids might go to school somewhere. We might be part of a congregation or a church. Whoever we are, we're part of something greater than ourselves. And when we say, hey, what could we do together to make a difference? That's where action happens. And that's where I believe hope starts.
You know, in my own experience, I've found there are places where climate activists, I don't know that I really believe in that word, but let's say for now, those who are strongly inclined, there are places where climate activists can talk. There are places where I guess deniers seem to talk, but there are very few places where there really is a constructive dialogue. And I found that to be an interesting spot, but I find there just aren't many places that are enhancing dialogue. There are places that are reinforcing currently held views.
I completely agree with you. And that's why I feel like it's up to us to change that by starting those conversations wherever we are, wherever we're sort of planted, grow where you're planted, as they say. We're all part of groups of people who are bigger than ourselves. And it could just be our family that we're talking about, but it could be the people we, you know, play golf with or kayak with or the club that we're part of, or again, the place where we work. And we can say, hey, have we thought about, you know, doing an energy audit to save money? Oh, and that would also reduce our carbon emissions too. Or have we thought about where we get our electricity from? Or have we thought about saying, hey, it'd be great to have a place for people to plug in their cars since more people are getting electric vehicles these days? Or, hey, you know, what about encouraging, depending on where you lived, encouraging people to take public transportation and helping people afford transportation? And just looking at the things that we can do really together locally to make a difference, and then realizing, you know what, those actions can make a difference in people's lives today for the better. Oh, and they help with climate change too in the future. And those are the types of win-win solutions that we really need. And that's part of why I joined the Nature Conservancy, is because they have so many amazing nature-based solutions, as they call them. But they're nature-based solutions that, oh, they clean up our air and our water so we can breathe better air and we have cleaner water, and they restore biodiversity, which actually helps us too. And they help protect us from, those solutions help protect us from flood. They help us grow better food. They invest in our soils. There's all kinds of great solutions, again, that have win-win-wins today that make a difference in people's lives here and now. Oh, and they help with climate change as well. And when we see those solutions being implemented, we feel like, hey, you know, it didn't take a president or, you know, a CEO or a big, famous, wealthy, influential, you know, Hollywood person to do this. This was just an ordinary person who did this. And if they did that, and if that group did that, well, maybe we could too. And all of a sudden, before we know it, we're part of the solution. And that's what gives us hope.
Is Nature Conservancy perhaps one of the best examples, you think, of a group that's out there trying to foster true conversation, kind of bridging the gap sometimes between business and consumers and governments? Do you find that they are probably one of the better examples of that?
I think they are, and that's exactly why I joined them. Too many organizations, like you just said, are not there to bring more people into the conversation. They're simply there to have the conversation with the people who are already there. And if we don't bring more people in, we're never going to fix these problems. And the Nature Conservancy truly does believe in connecting with businesses, with landowners, with farmers, with cities, with everybody who lives in a region to say, how could we together have a better future? And I think those are exactly the conversations we need to be having.
You know, I want to commend you. I've listened to your TED Talk, by the way. It was a beautiful TED Talk. And I don't know about you, but for me, that's the scariest 10 minutes of my life. You didn't exhibit any fear in yours, but to be that vulnerable to me was petrifying, but you seemed to carry it off with dignity. And it was a great talk. And in that talk, you really mentioned two things that I find I could count on one hand and have some fingers left over that I find so important. You talked, one, about water conservation, and you clearly link, you know, perhaps impact on the climate and impact on the globe with water conservation. So I was glad to hear that. But you also talked about conservation. I believe you said it'd be so nice to have a switch when you walk out the door that you turned it off and it closed off everything in your house except for your refrigerator. We never talk about conservation nearly as much as I think we should, don't you?
Oh, completely. So a study that came out after I did my TED Talk, otherwise I would have referred to it, found that through efficiency alone, which is conservation to saving energy, we could cut U.S. carbon emissions in half and save a ton of money. The cheapest electricity is the one that you don't use. And, you know, it's like our grandparents told us, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Somehow we've just built these really wasteful ways where we're just, you know, wasting all kinds of things that we don't need to, and we would save money if we didn't. And so I'm actually excited to give you an update. We're moving into a place that's just being built, not a home, but a townhouse, and they gave us the option to have that control. And it's not even a switch by your front door. It's on your phone where you can turn everything in the house off when you leave. You can have like an away mode and you set everything you want to go off when you're away. Obviously not the freezer, right? But most of the other things. And then you just walk out of the house and push the button. And I'm so pleased. And when that actually, you know, when we move in and when I see that happening, I'm going to be telling everybody about it because I think everybody should have the ability to do that.
I think very few people realize the technology that's moving so quickly to do things like conserve energy and use less energy. We see it every day in our business as we work with builders, but just some of it's obvious, better insulation and doors and windows, but some of it is just better technology and heat pumps that operate better or furnaces that are wildly efficient. I know we will introduce next week an engine that would be an alternative to diesel, and it will be one of the most efficient engines ever built. And it's nothing special. I mean, it will be an engine that will become ubiquitous, I think, across the country for powering trucks and pumping water and providing power. And so I think it's really just the wave of the future. But most people don't, I think, realize the technology innovation that's occurring across all forms of energy.
No,
all right, well, let's go ahead.
One of the organizations that I talk about in my book is out in Iowa, the Renewable Energy Group. So they take waste products. They take agricultural waste and old cooking oil, so things that we wouldn't be using to make anything out of, and they turn it into biodiesel fuel that you can burn in regular diesel engines. I mean, that's another example of just taking a waste product, turning it into a useful fuel. And the amazing thing is because those plants grew pretty recently, they took the carbon out of the atmosphere pretty recently. So when you burn them, they're putting back in the carbon that was taken out just last year, which is completely different than when we actually burn diesel fuel. We're putting carbon into the atmosphere that hasn't been there for millions of years. So there's just such potential to take things that we don't currently value in our society and turn them into useful products and save ourselves a ton of money. Oh, and sure, it helps with climate change too, so to speak, but we've got benefits here and now.
And I might add that very same facility you talk about that's making renewable diesel is also making renewable propane, which is highly valued for its reduced carbon impact. In fact, we use part of that to trundle out a carbon zero molecule for powering vehicles around the country. And that's real today. So yeah, REG has been a partner of ours for probably almost a decade now.
Huh,
and we're really proud of that partnership. Yeah. Let's talk about a few things. I mean, I think one, I want to ask you a question because we talk mainly about America. You certainly have a Canadian point of view. But when you were talking with Jimmy Kimmel, you said something that I wanted to challenge you on. You said, I'll quote you, in fact, China is beating the pants off of us. And while you didn't finish it in that statement, I think it was really referring to in a race to a cleaner climate. Kind of elaborate on that statement, because I found that somewhat inconsistent with my own readings.
Well, yes. And unfortunately, that's the problem with TV is they don't let you finish your statements. And how is a scientist supposed to be accurate if she can't finish her statements? So what I meant to say is they're beating the pants off the United States in wind and solar energy.
Ah.
The reason why solar energy is so cheap is because China, as a government, invested in it substantially to bring that price down. And here in Texas, where I live, we're benefiting from that incredibly. So, you know, Texas has more wind energy than any other state in the country. And I know that you lived in Texas, so we can brag on Texas together. And when I first moved to Texas, which was 15 years ago, the state wasn't even top 10 on solar. Well, now Texas is number 2 in the U.S. on solar, and it's aiming for number 1. And there's the biggest solar plant in the U.S. currently being built just outside the DFW area. But people don't realize China, they burn a lot of coal and they have a lot of coal. But they have more wind and solar energy than the United States. And so the United States is in serious danger of being left behind technologically when we look at what China and what India are investing very heavily in for the future. And so that's what we have to realize, is that the energy mix is changing quickly, and there are other countries that are thinking a little further ahead than the United States is. And if the United States wants to maintain its technological advantage, it has to realize that just, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here, and there's many people who would already agree and who already know this, but we have to realize that just as we no longer use the party line telephone, but it was useful at that time, there will be a future that is not very distant when we will be transitioning entirely to a huge range, not just one, but a range of clean energy sources that are no longer directly powered by fossil fuels. And some countries at the national level have already internalized that into their policies in a way that the United States hasn't. And that is, you know, I'm not a policy expert myself, but I would assume as a human being thinking about this, that would pose a significant long-term risk to the economy.
Yes, I am glad you clarified that. I enjoyed the interview, although parts of it were, I could only feel sorry for you as Jimmy Kimmel is playing the crazy uncle or whatever, but I thought you handled it with great dignity.
Thank you.
But
that was not rehearsed.
You could see. Let's just kind of talk about a few other things. In your writings and a lot of the talks I followed, you really talk about, let's have this conversation, right? Let's knowledge is power to a degree. And I completely agree, and I'm all on board. The next step, though, is we need to begin to take action. And at least as I work with people, I find people are willing to engage in a conversation. Perhaps they're willing to think about their role in conservation, but they don't seem to be willing to step forward and pay more. Now, so in your thoughts, once we foster conversation, we have knowledge, we have agreement, how do we get people to move forward and act?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So 20 or 30 years ago, often you really couldn't afford to act unless you had money to burn. But these days, it's becoming increasingly possible. So, for example, if an individual wants to get solar panels on their roof, there are credit unions now that will give you a loan where the monthly payment is $100 below your average power bill over the last year. So that's no longer, you know, a luxury. That's something that already happens and already exists. There's a lot of big corporations and actually the federal government as well, and they have the biggest fleet in the country. So corporations like Amazon, I just heard about a new one today that's doing this too, that are transitioning to clean electric vehicles and trucks and delivery vans. So they're placing these huge orders that are going to bring down the price for everyone else. So it's going to be at the point where you don't have to, you know, pay double or triple. It's pretty soon going to be, you might pay a little bit more or even just the same. But even if you pay a little bit more, if you look over the next year, two or three, where you don't have to buy fuel and you can use electricity instead, if you look longer term, you're already saving money. It's gotten to the point now, I think the light bulb is a good example of this. So it used to be, and I'm sure you remember, LEDs used to be quite expensive and hard to find. But nowadays, they're so affordable and you can get them, you know, you just walk into your local Walmart and there they are. They're so affordable that if somebody gave you a free incandescent light bulb versus if you had to go and buy a regular LED, after just a few months, you would be losing money on the free incandescent light bulb because it uses that much more electricity. So that's where we've already headed in some areas, and that's where we need to head with this technology because it needs to be available to everybody. It needs to be not a luxury. It needs to be the cheapest thing. And if you want something that burns fossil fuels, you can still get it, but it's going to cost you more.
Dr. Hayhoe, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll continue our conversation right after this.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com. Maybe I'll win
6x0. Welcome back. We're talking with climate scientist Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. I spend my life, I think, dealing with the climate. I am a lover of Texas values, and I certainly am a Christian. You are all of those things as well. You are a climate scientist. You're a Texan, although you came here from Canada for whatever box that checks. And you certainly, you know, have written quite a bit about being evangelical Christian. Talk to me about why you think, why is that so viewed as such a unique set of values? Why I really stress with that myself, that the implication is you cannot be from Texas and be for climate. You cannot be a Christian and be for climate. Why do you think people perceive that to be so unique?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think that they are completely compatible with each other. In fact, the reason I am a climate scientist is because I'm a Christian. I was planning to study astrophysics, and that's what my undergraduate degree is in. And when I was finishing out my undergrad degree and I was already starting to do research and I was already looking, you know, at where I would be going for graduate school, I had to take an extra class to finish my degree. And there was a brand new class on climate change. I thought, well, that looks interesting. Why not take it? So I took it. And that's where I learned for the first time that climate change is not only an environmental issue that environmentalists worry about and the rest of us wish them well. Climate change is a profoundly human issue. It affects every single one of us. It affects our water, our food, the safety of our homes, and it affects the poorest and most vulnerable people more than anyone, and that's not fair. And as a Christian, I believe that we're called to love our neighbor. And I believe that we're called to care for those less fortunate than us. And so that was what led me to become a climate scientist. And I truly believe that if we take the Bible seriously and if we understand who exactly is already being affected by climate change today, we'd be out at the front of the line demanding climate action. And in fact, there are a lot of Christians who are already there. So what about Texas then? Well, Texas is the most vulnerable state in the whole country to climate impacts. Number one. Texas already naturally has more billion-dollar weather and climate disasters than any other state, naturally, because we get it all. We get hurricanes and blizzards and ice storms and dust storms and tornadoes and hailstorms. We get everything. And then the biggest way climate change is affecting us today is by loading the weather dice against us. So in other words, wherever we live, it's like we have a pair of dice and we have, you know, two sixes on our dice, so we could always roll a flood or a drought or a storm. And Texas already has three sixes on its dice. It already gets more of these crazy events than any other state just because of its geographic location where it is. But as the planet warms decade by decade, it's as if it's sneaking in and taking some of the other numbers on the dice and changing those into sixes or even sevens. And so Texas is right in the crosshairs of stronger hurricanes and more devastating droughts and more deadly heat waves, and we even get wildfires. And it's crazy, and this is why I call this problem global weirding rather than global warming. We even know that a warming Arctic is making those crazy ice storms that we get here in Texas stronger. Because when the Arctic warms, it's like the freezer door swings open and all that water just pours, or water, all that cold air just pours all the way down to Texas. So Texas is already the most vulnerable state. Texas is home to the oil and gas industry. But more importantly, in my opinion, Texas understands energy. Texas is already number one in wind energy in the U.S., like we said before, number two in solar. And Texas truly has the ability to lead the United States and lead the world into this new clean energy economy. I mean, I've actually calculated this. If Texas wanted to supply the whole U.S. with electricity, and, you know, you don't want one state supplying the whole U.S. for obvious reasons, but if it wanted to, you would only need about 100 by 100 square mile area, which is what, like six cotton farms between Lubbock and Amarillo? All you would need is 100 by 100 square miles covered in solar panels, and that would be enough energy for the whole country, enough electricity, I should say, to be specific. So Texas has so much potential to lead that I truly feel if you're a Texan, you have every reason to be out at the front of demanding action and demanding a clean energy economy.
And you left out one more issue for Texas. You have probably the most rapidly growing population,
yes,
in the U.S. as we kind of move from urban to rural. We seem to also be moving from north to south in Texas, according to the U-Haul survey, at least, that just was released. Gets its disproportionate share of those migrations. So a rapidly changing population, as all of us know who try to drive in Dallas or Austin or Houston for that matter. Yeah.
Well, that you're exactly right. I teach in the public administration program at Texas Tech University. And this week, my graduate students are learning about how disaster is a function of three things. There is the actual, you know, the climate or weather hazard, so a hurricane or a drought or a storm. But then you have to have two other things for it to be a disaster. You have to have exposure, which means the number of people and the amount of valuable infrastructure that's exposed. And as you just said, Texas, not only the state itself is growing fastest of any state population-wise, but Texas has most of the cities in the top 10 fastest growing cities too. And then the third factor is vulnerability. That's
right.
How prepared we are. And that's the reason why we had such a huge impact from the Texas freeze last year. It was vulnerability. You know, they have natural gas. They have wind turbines, you know, up in Scandinavia. They have wind turbines in the Arctic. And why is it that we had such a freeze in Texas and it shut down our power system? Because we were not prepared. They didn't install the winterization equipment,
right,
on the wind turbines or the natural gas lines that they could have done. And the vulnerability was why that led it to a disaster. And just to be totally clear, only 13% of that was the actual turbines. The vast majority of it was the fact that they failed to winterize the natural gas. So vulnerability, exposure, and hazard adds up to disaster. And we have something to do in each one of those to help reduce the impact of that disaster. And like I said, Texas is really in the crosshairs there. We have the most to lose, but we also have the most to gain.
Right. So I'm going to start wrapping up. I want to ask you two important questions, and then we'll get to the fun part of the show as well. But I've listened to you, I've read your work, and you will take a pot shot every once in a while at the oil and gas industry. In that, you know, they, you might argue, as kind of a writer in the a couple journals talks about, holding on to their past. But as I look at the solutions that we will ultimately need to impact the climate in a positive way, I often feel like they're of such scale, of such magnitude, that it will take large corporations. So what do you think the role of existing oil and gas, and we can pick good ones if you want, we can pick names like Chevron or BP, but what do you think the role, and or if you don't want to, if you want to stay away from oil and gas, we can go to plastics, but what do you think the role of those large corporations will be in the race to improve climate?
Well, I think that, first of all, that there definitely is a role, and that's not something everyone would agree on. But I don't think there's a role for everyone, because we are definitely reducing our use of these products. There's no way around it. We can't fix climate change and not reduce it. So companies like BP are really taking the lead in transitioning a large part of their business model to look at alternative fuels and how to be more efficient with the resources that we do have. So there are good actors who are trying. And that's why this is such a, it's not a black and white issue. It's a gray issue because we need to transition as much as possible. There are some people who feel paralyzed, some industries that feel paralyzed, that feel stuck, that don't feel that there are solutions for them. There are some, I regret to say, who deliberately chose to try to obfuscate, to sow doubt, to attack scientists like me, to try to convince people that it wasn't a real problem, or to try to convince people that it was all their fault, not the company's fault. Whereas in reality, of course, we are consumers, but they're producing the product. We're all in this together, all of us. So we need solutions that work for all of us, because when it all comes down to it, we're all humans. We Right. all live on this planet. We all depend on it for everything that we have. The air that we breathe, quite literally, the water we drink, and the food that we eat. That's why I called my book, Not Saving the Planet. The planet will be orbiting the sun long after we're gone. It really is about saving us.
Saving us, humans. Yeah.
And we have to do it together or not at all.
Well said. So I don't get a lot of climate scientists on here, and it's interesting that you're on the day after the Wall Street Journal has, I guess, 3/4 of a page dedicated to the latest in climate modeling. If you didn't see it, it's pretty fascinating, and it kind of focuses around the group in Boulder. But where do you think that we are today with climate? The article is talking about the complexity, and now, you know, even with millions of lines of code, the complexity as we think about the impact of clouds or the impact of these levels of CO2. But where do you find you think we are today with climate modeling? Do you think it's relatively accurate?
So this is my field. I can answer this not just in a generic way, but very specifically. I would say, first of all, we have to realize that the planet is as complex as a human body. So there are always new things to learn about this incredible planet that we live on. And that's part of the scientific discovery that I enjoy the most, is learning many of those things. Why do we have climate models? Because we can't put the Earth in a test tube. The way scientists learn about physical systems is by experimenting on them. And so we build our best representation of the Earth's climate system with ocean currents and trees and soil and clouds and volcanoes and humans and cities. We build our best representation using the most powerful supercomputers in the world. And every time they have a new supercomputer that comes online, we have a climate model waiting for it, because we want to go as granular as possible. We want to get as much detail as possible. We know that cloud microphysics is so important. We want to get down to the scale of water droplets in order to understand our planet. But the basic facts that climate is changing, humans are responsible, the impacts are serious, and the more fossil fuels we dig up and burn, the thicker the blanket we're wrapping around our planet. Those basic facts have been known since the 1850s, and they remain unchanged today. In 1890s, Svante Arrhenius, who was a Nobel Prize winning physical chemist, in his spare time, because that's what scientists do in their spare time, he decided to calculate the very first climate model in the world by hand in the 1890s. He calculated how much each latitude band of the Earth would warm, because we know, and he discovered, that the Arctic would warm faster than the rest of the Earth. He calculated how much each latitude band would warm if we increased levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by 50%, or we doubled them, or we tripled them. It took him 2 years to do his calculations. But those calculations that he did in the 1890s are pretty much identical to the ones we get from the most powerful supercomputers today. Amazing. So sure, we're always learning more, but we know more than enough to act, and we've known it for over a century.
Right. Good points. All right, here's the fun part. This is the one place that we deal in magic every now and then, other than maybe Harry Potter's. And we're going to hand you a magic wand, and you get to use that magic wand for one thing in the next year regarding climate change that you want to have changed. So I'm going to hand you this wand and I want you to tell us how you'd use this wand to change one thing in the next year regarding this conversation around the climate.
Okay, that's a really tough one, because there's degrees of magic there. So if I could just wave a magic wand to put a single policy in place, I would put a price on carbon. Because we are already paying that price, but in a way that we can't currently see. And I think everybody deserves to be making appropriate financial decisions so that they're not sort of caught when something bites them from behind because we didn't realize that climate change was increasing the cost of our insurance, or disasters, or, you know, that we'd lose our crop insurance. So that's a sort of a quasi-realistic magic wand, just getting it in place.
Yeah, so that's a great use. That's a great use. Why do you think there's so much reluctance to even have a serious conversation around pricing carbon?
Well, I think it goes back to what we talked about at the very beginning, that the United States is now more politically polarized than it's been since the Civil War. Because the idea of pricing carbon is essentially a free market solution. Almost every economist in the world, including the two who won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago, supports and endorses it. There's a bipartisan climate solutions caucus in Congress and the Senate, made of half Democrats and half Republicans, who agree on it. There's the Climate Leadership Council, with a lot of major corporations whose names you'd recognize, like AT&T and a lot of even the big oil and gas companies, who support pricing carbon. I'm from Canada, where there's a national price on carbon. And there's a lot of support from it, but we live in a society now where, again, we see compromise as weakness. We see the other side's loss as our gain. And so anything that people could possibly agree on across the aisle seems to immediately fall into that chasm that divides us, that is just getting wider and wider every day. And that's why, again, to circle right back, those conversations that each of us has is so important. Not arguing, not trying to convince people, not trying to change people, but just trying to say, look, we all have reasons to care on this. You care because of this, I care because of that. Hey, you know, we might even disagree on that, but let's come together on what we can agree on, because there's so much more we agree on than we disagree on. And if we could just work on what we agree on, we could get so much done.
It's well said. I want to plug your website. Everyone can learn more about Dr. Hayhoe at www.catherinehayhoe.com. And would you love to tell our listeners maybe what you're working on, and a fresh book, somewhere you're gonna appear in the near term?
Absolutely. So what I'm working on right now is putting discussion questions and short videos on my website for the book Saving Us. So if you're wondering, well, how would I start a conversation? Think about, well, maybe we could have a book discussion group. And I'm going to put the questions up so people can, you know, you don't even have to think of your own questions. And if you want to watch a short video in each section, we're going to have those too. So people can use that as a conversation starter, I'm hoping. And I also do a lot on social media, on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or even LinkedIn. So if people want more, just follow me there, share the resources, and use those to start your own conversations too.
Awesome. For everyone who appears on this show, we have a great tradition of planting a tree in your honor in a national forest. Now, you're in Texas, you're from Canada, but Do you have a specific piece of woods that you are fond of? Because we'd love to plant a tree there in your honor.
Thank you. Well, as you mentioned earlier, all of my in-laws are from Virginia, so I would love to plant a tree in Virginia because it's such a beautiful forested area.
Well, we will find one right there in the Blue Ridge Mountains for you, and I will be proud to do that myself. So we will do just that. Thank you.
Thank you. I have certainly spent many happy hours hiking in that area, so that would be such a pleasure.
Such a beautiful place. I want to plug your book one more time. The title of the book, Saving Us, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope and Healing in a Divided World. What a lovely time we spent together. I cannot thank you enough for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Well, that wraps us up for this episode. And a quick reminder, if you want to send me a note or make a comment on an episode or give us a new topic to consider, just shoot us an email. The address is path2zero@propane.com. That's path2zero@propane.com. I look forward to hearing from you. With that, a big thank you to everyone listening. See you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.